Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio, free radio.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show. F'ing up the airwaves since 2007.
You're listening to The F Word. The F Word is a syndicated show produced on unceded Coast Salish territories, Vancouver, BC, Canada, at CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. For more information about The F Word Media Collective, you can go to our website at feminisms.org. You can hear our shows through that site, plus cooperadio.org, rabble.ca, archive.org, Pacifica Radio, and iTunes. And every week we broadcast live from East Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish territory. I'm Sarah Jo, and today on The F Word, we are airing a panel conversation about feminism and the media in 2014, which was recorded live at Bar Talk as one of the University of British Columbia's Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center and the Terry Project's Gordon Caddick hosted the Bar Talk panel discussion on January 15th that reviewed the past year in feminism and media and looked at what has changed and what we can expect for 2015. We are airing discussions by panelists Lucia Lorenzi and Jera Hodge. Lucia Lorenzi is a fifth-year PhD candidate in English at UBC. She's currently working on her dissertation, which focuses on the aesthetics and politics of silence in narratives of sexual violence. You can find her on Twitter at @EmpathyWarrior. Jera Hodge is the author of the award-winning feminist blog GenderFocus.com and writes about gender, politics, and labor issues. She has also written blog series for Bitch Magazine and the Vancouver Observer.
So the format for today is really simple. We're going to do some brief introductions. Everyone's going to talk a little bit about why they're here and what they do. And then we're going to guide the conversation through some important moments in 2014. What we're doing is essentially reviewing the year, what's happened, what the conversations were like, and really what it means for 2015. Without further ado, why don't we begin with Jera?
Thanks. It's really great to be here. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm here because 2014 was a serious roller coaster in feminist issues, and I am really tired, but really optimistic as a result of some of the things that happened. I'll just pick out a few, I guess, like low-light highlights, because almost everything, it seems, was a low-low that turned into something that could be really inspiring. The first one was the shootings at UC Santa Barbara, and the response after that. I'm sure I wasn't the only one who was really like glued to Twitter, just being like trying to make sense of this, because it was so clearly similar to Montreal in 1980s. It was so clearly similar to the shootings in the gym in Philadelphia in 2009. And then there were people who were like, oh, but it's just, you know, as often happens when the shooter is white, this is just a lone wolf. It's someone who's mentally disturbed. And women said, no, this is systemic. And the response to, well, not all men, was yes, all women. And that was a really powerful response that had over 2 million tweets in 4 days. And the rest of the year just kind of kept going like that. I'm sure we're going to talk about John Gomeshi later, so I won't get a lot into that. But another couple things that happened that were like a bit smaller and definitely more local, so I'm going to just mention them now in case we don't get around to them again, there was the situation with Trish Kelly, who was a Parks Board candidate, who was sort of basically told she couldn't run because there was a video that came out of her talking about masturbation in a performance piece that was several years old. And it was really awesome to see that The discussion about that and how ridiculous that was really kept going. And while she wasn't able to run, she was able to have two sold out forums on how issues, the barriers on women in politics and LGBTQ people in politics. And now she's basically been able to become a real public presence and a columnist and a public spokesperson. So that was really encouraging. And then another thing that I think was a victory that came out of a bad thing, was around, abortion issues in New Brunswick. And, the activists that came out around that, because the Morgenthaler Clinic was basically forced to close because of stupid provincial regulations that don't exist anywhere else in Canada. The activists came out and instead of saying, you know, well, we aren't going to debate this issue because it's been won, which is sort of the general tactic. They said, no, we're going to debate this issue and we're going to win and we're going to make it an election issue. And they won. And so it's really like, that's really heartening to me. So it's been a really tiring year. It's really demanded a lot of us. And there's been a lot of talk about, is this a watershed moment in feminism? I think overall, it's definitely a shift. And we can see that in the media. But I think that what we have to avoid is thinking that watershed moments means we get to sit back and let the tide wash over us, and that it's more about seeing ourselves as a drop of water that has to figure out how to work with all the other drops to push the dam down.
So hi, everyone. My name is Lucia. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of English, and I also write a lot about sexual violence and kind of all of its forms. So as I kind of look back at 2014, as with every year in the past few years, kind of feel a weird mix of like hope, like super hope and really excited, and like despair, like curled up in my blanket, not wanting to look at the internet because it's just, there's too much. So I'll kind of start with the things that make me hopeful. I've been really, really encouraged by the diversity of feminist voices in the media, particularly women of color, especially trans women of color. That's been really amazing to see that been, you know, Janet Mock just got an amazing mainstream show. Also the grassroots activism by people on campuses all across North America regarding sexual violence and putting pressure on institutions, and we're seeing that of course now with Dalhousie over the past month, and it's ongoing, just to see, you know, campus communities taking responsibility for the community. As well as having really difficult conversations and kind of simple conversations, right? Like when Beyoncé was on the VMAs and feminist was splattered across the screen. We have to have these discussions about what is feminism before we can kind of talk about what feminism is in practice. So it's been really amazing to see those discussions mainstream. As far as the despair part, I think my biggest despair is, particularly here in Canada, is seeing the Conservative government continue to refuse to call an inquiry into more than 1,000 missing and murdered Indigenous women, even though rave survivors like Renelle Harper, who was left for dead in a Winnipeg river, have called for it explicitly. Also just sort of the incredible violence that we're seeing, especially online. And it's really, violence online is a tricky thing, right? Because we talk about, you know, words are just words, but it's going beyond that, right? We're seeing a lot of doxing, a lot of threats. So that's been really difficult. And then these big cases about sexual violence and sort of seeing how many decades of cover-ups are involved in this and what is it going to take for us to make change. So what I hope, you know, to do tonight in conjunction with all of you and great panelists is sort of, how do we maintain that energy and solidarity going forward when things are so difficult? And how do we listen to each other and give space and time to stories and voices that aren't usually given space and time? So thank you.
So we're going to start with the despair, unfortunately. CJ, first slide.
Happy Tuesday.
Well, hi there. My name is Gian Gomeshi.
He started, like, rubbing me with both of his hands kind of everywhere.
Pulled my hair, threw me up against the wall by my throat, cut off my breathing.
He said, I want to hate fuck you to wake you
and
up.
He started hitting me, close fist, in the side of my head.
One step back. So why don't we begin just maybe by, like, first impressions. Do you remember, Lucia, the moment that you learned?
So when Gian Gomeshi posted the, like, I'm going on a break, and I don't usually tweet at celebrities, but I'm like, oh, like, take care of yourself, man. Like, be good to yourself. And it was sort of like this moment of having him in my mind as I was, you know, going about my day and then seeing everything slowly break apart. For many other people, Q is a part of my daily commute here. I think the radio and the media creates a sense of intimacy with people, that we think that we know who people are. I remember when Gian hosted a debate, I think it was in April of last year, on rape culture. And I was like, yeah, great. Like, you know, a primetime or like, you know, a daytime show and prominent media arts and culture show talking about this. And it was certainly a really difficult moment for all of us as a nation as a whole, because the CBC is ostensibly our corporation because our tax dollars go towards it. But just seeing woman after woman after woman come forward and wondering, and I still wonder, how many are there? That's the thing that I struggle with, knowing how many victims are there. Maybe we'll never know. But for now, I feel encouraged in some ways that there has been decisive action and charges laid, but there's still a whole, you know, mess that's been left behind.
One of the interesting things is how it was allowed to go on for so long. And the next example we have is maybe another one just like that. CJ?
Kids on TV, pull your pants up, black people. I was on TV in the 80s. I can talk down to you because I had a successful sitcom. Yeah, it was great women, Bill Cosby, so kind of brings it down a couple notches. I don't curse on stage. Well, yeah, you're a rapist, so...
So the interesting thing about that is that there were allegations that Cosby was sexually assaulting people for a long time, and not until this moment did it sort of, there was a groundswell. And I guess that kind of speaks to some issues here. Why do you think it takes so long in some of these cases, these high profile cases, for these things to surface?
I think that there's also reluctance to push the issue because people see what happens to other people who come forward and who try to push the issue. I mean, we've seen, you know, the attacks that there have been on Dylan Farrow about her allegations about Woody Allen. In both of these cases, we had like half a dozen women before people started to say, maybe there's something here. And that shouldn't have to be the case. It shouldn't have to be that, like, the more famous you are, the more people you get to attack before people take it seriously.
Yes, all women.
Yes.
All men.
Yes.
All people.
Equality.
Because we can.
Because we should.
Because we're not there yet.
Because we need to keep the conversation going.
So, Jerry, you mentioned that in your introduction. Can you give us a little bit more context?
I mean, after those murders, it came out that the shooter had released this manifesto where he talked about how he planned to kill women, although he didn't use that term for women. He used many worse terms in sororities, basically for refusing to sleep with him. And like I said, it bore really strong similarities, especially to the shootings in the gym in 2009 in the States. That was a very similar, like, man who shot women because they wouldn't date him. And the language was terrifying. And it started to be portrayed in the media still, though they were, some cases, ignoring the manifesto totally and just saying mental health issues, which is a whole separate, bigger issue of how, you know, it reinforces the idea that people who have mental health issues are more likely to commit violence when, in fact, they're more likely to be victims of violence. Then on Twitter, the feminists were saying, you know, this is a serious issue. This is about misogyny. And a lot of men started saying, well, not all men do this kind of thing. So stop painting this as an issue about sexism or about misogyny. It's because I'm a nice guy and I have never shot anyone. Okay, great. But then a Twitter user whose name was Gilded Spine started a thing saying, but yes, all women experience this fear of male violence. Like, yes, all women have been told, you know, don't walk home at night alone. That sparked a bigger wave of tweets saying that, you know, we have to talk about how this is a systemic issue. We can't let this be painted as a lone wolf. Because a lot of women felt really afraid when we saw that, because we know what it's like to feel afraid of violence, even if, you know, that person might be a totally nice guy, but we're conditioned and taught from the time we're a very young age to be afraid.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what kind of came out of the Elliot Rodgers situation is that there was a conversation about the fear that many women have about turning men down. But there's also been a lot of publicized incidents where people have been killed. So there was a young Turkish woman in Germany who confronted men who were harassing two young women in a McDonald's, you know, bathroom, whatever. She broke it up. One of them came back, hit her over the head with a brick, and she died for intervening, right? And we tell people, be bystanders, intervene. A man in San Francisco was stabbed and nearly died because he defended his girlfriend against street harassment. Another young woman in the States was killed because she didn't want to go to the prom with somebody. Right, so these aren't isolated incidents. Elliot Rodgers is a very kind of extreme kind of end of the spectrum, maybe in terms of the preparing a manifesto and actually taking a firearm and kind of doing it like that. But it's certainly not unique. And what came up out of that were these strategies. And I tweeted a picture of like headphones and a fake engagement ring that I used to have when I worked at the Indie. Little things that are just sort of these protective mechanisms that we don't even think of, right? To just sort of ward it off. But of course, that brings up other issues of why do I have to pretend like I'm married in order to turn down dates? Anyway, that kind of stuff. So it certainly wasn't an isolated incident. And I think that we're seeing the fear of rejection being amplified. It's more than hurt feelings. It can be really deadly.
Oh, yeah, got one more question in front.
Hey, sorry. So similar to Jera, when I first heard about the Elliot Rodger thing, I was really disheartened, and then I was really excited by this hashtag, and I saw it as like this intense moment of solidarity. But then after the hashtag, after people started tweeting on the hashtag, there was like a backlash from women of color feminists who were kind of I remember Harsha Walia, but other women of color, trans feminists, talking about this hashtag and this Yes All Women idea as not being intersectional, as erasing the experiences, the different experiences of women from different subject positions. And I was wondering if any of you guys would speak to that or how you felt about those criticisms, whether you felt they were valid or what.
I mean, even the idea of having a hashtag that says Yes All Women, well, who are we considering in that category of woman, right? That is a big question in and of itself. But I want to talk about an initiative that was created by a woman named Feminista Jones. You might follow her on Twitter. And she started an initiative called You OK, Sis, which is explicitly talking about women of color, especially Black women who face street harassment in much different ways than especially white women, about creating a specific type of initiative to talk about their experiences in that community. And a lot of people pushed back against You OK, Sis, saying, well, why wasn't Yes All Women enough? Why do we need something specifically for Black women? And as women started to talk about their very specific racialized experiences, it became evident that, you know, Yes All Women was wonderful in some ways because we can have a globalized conversation. But the violence that we face is always local. It's always individual. It's in our bodies, right? And our bodies occupy all these various and different subject positions, whether it's race, gender, sexuality, and so on. So, I absolutely agree. I think that seeing that tension between women who are ostensibly fighting for the same cause, not kind of giving space to those very specific racialized experiences, is really, really difficult.
I totally agree. And I think that's been, I think, a positive way that conversations have been happening on Twitter is, you know, something starts and then there gets to be a critique. And hopefully, and like in that case, it's a totally fair critique. I think Solidarity for White Women as a hashtag was also last year. I guess my like one piece of advice for people who are on Twitter is if you're a white person and that people of color start a hashtag like that, like read it and retweet it, but don't try to say like, why do we need this? And don't try to like take over the conversation. Cause you see some people trying to do that and I'm sure they mean really well. But it's a really, really important opportunity. And a really excellent way that you can sit and read people's thoughts that are being really generous in sharing their feelings and their thoughts and their experiences and to listen and help amplify their voices.
So I just want to give everyone an opportunity to give some brief comments on hopes and prospects for 2015 and what you're looking forward to.
I am looking forward to having a federal election and hoping getting rid of Stephen Harper.
I think I'm cautiously optimistic. That's kind of weird to say. Like, I want to be optimistic. I really do. But I, you know, coming out of writing a bunch of stuff about Dalhousie and the things that have been going on there, I feel like, I need to have cautiousness, because it's really easy for, I think, optimism about the struggle can also be co-opted and sold and branded and fed back to us. It's like, don't worry, like, we're making progress. It's a watershed moment. It's okay. So I think that my optimism is always cautious, but not cautious in a I'm terrified way, but critical, right? My optimism is always critical and engaging in theory. So, yeah.
This is the F Word. For more information, you can go to feminisms.org.
I'm Carissa Raponin in the studio with my co-host, Sarah Jo, and you are listening to the F Word. You heard Bartok, a panel discussion about feminism in the media in 2014 and their hopes for 2015. The panel discussion was part of the University of British Columbia's Sexual Assault Awareness Month and was hosted by The Terry Project, a documentary radio show broadcast from CITR 101.9 FM at the University of British Columbia, and we used the recording with their permission. To spotlight one of the pieces discussed in Bartok, we are going to look closer at the impacts of Gamergate by airing a talk by Anita Sarkeesian from XOXO Fest in September 2014. XOXO is an arts and technology festival in Portland, Oregon, celebrating independent artists using the internet to do what they love. She spoke about the backlash she has faced in the last 2 years as a feminist media critic and creator of Feminist Frequency. She speaks specifically about the online harassment and threats targeting her by mostly men for her work in challenging misogyny in the gaming industry and gaming culture. According to XOXO, 2 years ago, Anita Sarkeesian decided to use Feminist Frequency, her video series on the portrayal of women in the media, to document sexist stereotypes and cliches in video games. That project, Tropes vs. Women Video Games, ignited a sustained campaign of violent threats and abuse while raising over $150,000 from nearly 7,000 supporters. Despite the intense scrutiny, each video is essential viewing, a free masterclass in gender studies. Here is Anita Sarkeesian speaking to the impact of misogynist backlash and the power of feminist media.
Please welcome Anita Sarkeesian.
Thank you. Y'all are gonna make me cry up here. Hi. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, as you already know, apparently. So I run an educational nonprofit organization called Feminist Frequency, and as part of that project, I host an ongoing series of long-form video essays on YouTube analyzing the representations of women in popular video games. Now, video games are kind of a big deal these days. Gaming is a multi-billion dollar industry with an enormous impact on our larger cultural landscape. What you may not know is that gaming and gaming communities are currently undergoing a massive paradigm shift. The cultural, political, and economic structures of the medium are in the process of fundamentally transforming. While women have always played and made games, for several decades the industry catered almost exclusively to a straight, white, male demographic. This is no longer the case. The new reality is that gaming is becoming a more diverse and inclusive environment for everyone. That metamorphosis is happening, slowly and sometimes painfully, but it's happening. This is great news. However, I'm here today to share a little bit about the phenomenon of very vocal, aggressive, mostly male gamers who are unwilling or unable to accept this new reality. Their reactionary response can only be described as a massive and terrifying assault directed at the female fans, developers, and critics who feel they are destroying games. I imagine they feel something like this.
Where are the video games? All right, I can't breathe.
So, as some of you may already know, my video series explores series exploring topics such as the damsel in distress has been met with critical acclaim and positive responses from gamers and developers alike. But it has also been accompanied by a fair amount of anger. That's me with, you can't see because it's so bright in here, but I have like glowing red eyes. In fact, over the last 2 years, I've been made into something of a folk demon by some very angry men, especially those that hang out on certain parts of Reddit and 4chan. They have figuratively and literally concluded that I'm some kind of Disney villain who is personally responsible for the ongoing transformation of the gaming industry. Of course, I'm definitely not in charge of cultural shift. No one person is. But in their delusion, they've decided to believe that if they take me out, all will return to normal. So for the last 2 years, they have viciously and aggressively come after me by any means necessary. These next couple of slides are pretty graphic. I've been attacked with a constant torrent of grotesque misogynist harassment, everything from gendered hate speech to weaponized pornography, where they superimpose my face on pornographic images and then spam me with them, to bomb threats, rape threats, and death threats directed at me and my family and my colleagues. And there are ongoing investigations taking place for the worst of these crimes. So those are pretty clear and obvious forms of misogyny. Today, however, I'd like to talk to you about some of the more subtle forms of sexism that are not as obviously recognizable as the overt threats and slurs we saw a moment ago. Specifically, I'd like to focus on two strategies that these harassers have used in defaming me and my project: online impersonation and spreading conspiracy theories. I'm going to deconstruct my own experience to illustrate how this works in practice, but it's certainly not unique to me. The tactics of defamation are used as weapons to try and undermine the work and credibility of women in gaming and geek and tech-oriented subcultures. And for many women, including myself, slander and libel are the background radiation of our daily lives on the internet. So, the first, impersonation. Impersonation is a favored tactic employed to try and discredit women, especially feminists, who are often depicted as evil, man-hating feminazis. Because my work is straightforward, textual analysis delivered in a calm, analytical tone, and because I don't resemble that caricature, detractors often fabricate false quotes out of thin air in order to stereotype me as a more familiar villain. The creating of fake social media accounts on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook are common practice. The impersonation accounts steal and use my logos, my image, and my name to then post inflammatory or provocative statements. Let's look at a few examples. This very poorly photoshopped fake tweet was trying to imply that somehow I embezzled money from my Kickstarter funds for personal gain. This image was featured on Reddit, I think about a year ago, and quickly went viral, partially because it fits in nicely within this pre-existing sexist notion about women stealing from hardworking men in order to buy expensive shoes. I'm still getting hate mail about this a year later. For the record, these are the only shoes I'd ever consider paying $1,000 for.
Gentlemen, I give you the long fall boot. I'm not gonna lie to you, it's expensive as hell. But check this out. We told this test subject to just go ahead and try to land on her head. She can't do it. Good work, Boots. So anyway, we're between banks right now. Just make those checks out to cash. Cave Johnson, we're done here.
So there's some Portal fans in here. Great game. Okay, so another example is a couple years ago, I gave a talk at DICE, the game studio in Sweden that's responsible for the Battlefield series, as well as one of my favorite games, Mirror's Edge. Any fans, Mirror's Edge? Yeah. This was a private event for employees only. However, that did not stop some industrious harassers from creating and leaking a fake report about what I supposedly said. The gist of it is a completely made-up quote saying that Mirror's Edge is misogynist because the control scheme is too hard for female gamers. The ironic thing here is that not only did I never say that, but I actually have no problem with the game's control schemes, and apparently they do. Like the fake shoes tweet, this one has been widely distributed and accepted as fact in many corners of the internet. Again, even though it comes from 4chan, I receive regular hate mail about this every day. Or, not every day, but often. Okay, here are two more ridiculous fake quotes. One is decrying the much-beloved gaming company Valve. I don't know who would believe this is true, because that is so much more than 140 characters. Just saying. The other is stating that I believe murder is somehow not that bad, combined with a photo they stole from my personal Flickr account. So these are just a few examples, but what's important to understand is how quickly they become part of what is sometimes referred to as an information cascade. Information cascades occur when people rapidly repeat or share information from others without first verifying its validity. So falsehoods about me are initially pushed by detractors who use them to spam 4chan and Reddit as a way of provoking rage and rallying more people to join the crusade against me. As the disinformation spreads through social media, it takes on a life of its own. It's bouncing from Twitter to Facebook to Tumblr to YouTube and back again. Once the cascade reaches a critical mass, it no longer matters what the facts are. It becomes a viral meme. These hoaxes work to reinforce that folk demon narrative about me, right? The one that I mentioned earlier, because it's turning me into the embodiment of the most extreme irrational stereotype of feminism possible. The fake quotes also gain traction in the information cascade because they play on and help rationalize pre-existing paranoid fears about feminist interlopers and women invading video games. All of this becomes a part of the mythological canon of my villainy, supposedly proving that I really am as bad as they think, which then serves to as justification for further and more extreme forms of harassment. Given the prevalence of these impersonation-style hoaxes, it might not come as a surprise for you to learn that there are also a number of internet conspiracy theories about me and my work floating around out there. Now, when I say conspiracy theories, I'm talking full-on tinfoil hat, chemtrails, 9/11, truthers, birthers-type conspiracy theories. It's the kind of delusional belief subscribed to by those who are unable or unwilling to accept a changing reality. So, conspiracy theory number one. Anita Sarkeesian bleached her skin to appear more white, and she learned to smile like a white person in order to become popular. There's more. Then she used sophisticated neurolinguistic programming techniques to brainwash members of the gaming industry into seeing sexism where none really exists. This one comes courtesy of an obsessive fellow fond of ranting into his webcam while sporting a bathrobe. He has made over 60 YouTube rants about me, and some of those diatribes clock in at over 4 hours. Yeah, I wish I was kidding. So, my family is from Iraq. I'm proud to be Armenian. There are some very pernicious racial assumptions contained in the idea that I'm falsely portraying myself as white, though it falls under the broader umbrella of painting me as deceptive, that I'm concealing dangerous truths about myself that need to be exposed, in this case, my olive skin and my Middle Eastern roots. As for the charge of brainwashing, I'm sorry to say there are no subliminal mind control blipverts embedded in my educational video essays, but I do like to think that my rhetorical arguments are pretty good. Thank you. So this one is clearly ridiculous, but that's just the more hilarious tip of the iceberg, which leads us into some less funny and more harmful conspiracy theories built on a foundation of victim blaming and deep-seated misogyny. Conspiracy theory number two. Anita Sarkeesian is not a real gamer or even a real feminist. She's actually a con artist who fakes and orchestrates her own harassment in order to gain sympathy, which she uses to scam people into giving her money. It is kind of funny because it's so ridiculous. This is by far the most popular theory and takes one of two forms. One is Anita provokes the harassment on purpose by trolling and tricking the poor innocent kids on 4chan into harassing and threatening her. Version two is similar but takes it a step further. Anita fakes the threats and harassment she receives on a regular basis, either by sending these threats to herself via sock puppet accounts or by enlisting an army of feminists to do it for her. Where is that army? Seriously. So these scenarios are patently ridiculous, of course. I've been playing games since I was 5 years old, and I have never posted anything on 4chan in my life, nor will I ever, nor should any of you. Because honestly, the site is really just a cyber cesspool functioning as an incubator for misogyny. Yeah. So, as a side note, 4chaners do have a fondness for impersonating me as a way to troll each other into harassing me further. So this is an example of someone posting on 4chan pretending to be me, and they stole a photo from my Flickr account to do it. Okay, so remember those graphic rape and death threats I showed earlier? After I shared a few of these death threats on Twitter, this is how a surprisingly large number of gamers reacted. Beyond the shocking inability to show any empathy for women who are being harmed, we see an aggressive denial of women's experiences. Notice the paranoid language of false flag operations, which are commonly found in other political conspiracy theories. It is sometimes easier to believe unlikely or even ludicrous distortions of reality than it is to abandon or change a deeply held perspective. These theories are born out of a desire to explain away contradictions that don't fit neatly into these gamers' pre-existing worldview that gaming is and should continue to be the domain of young heterosexual men. The perpetrators do not see themselves as perpetrators at all. Instead, they see themselves as noble warriors fighting to save gaming from all those who dare suggest it ever change or grow up or mature. Conspiracy theories and impersonation hoaxes can often seem inconsequential or trivial, but they have the potential to shape and influence perceptions of reality and blur the lines between true and false. The constant flood of distortions has a snowball effect, wherein bits and pieces of disinformation can become surprisingly sticky. They slowly become accepted as part of the larger cultural myth around me in ways that shape public perception. And these theories and hoaxes pour over into every aspect of the harassment campaign against me. For every bit of harassment, every doxing attempt, every attack with pornographic images, with every death or rape threat I receive, you'll find these same type of conspiracy theories springing up in response. Each new accusation of false flags or faking threats and abuse building on the last one in a circular feedback loop. For these detractors, it is easier to believe that I'm a skin-bleaching, mind-controlling, video-game-hating scam artist involved in a masterful long con than it is to believe that the tide is turning in gaming and that larger numbers of developers and fans are challenging the sexist status quo and embracing the ideas and critiques expressed in my work and the work of many other women doing the same cultural criticism. Conspiracy theories are often driven by an underlying fear of authority. This particular paranoia about feminists taking over video games is further fueled by a deep underlying distrust of women. There is a prevailing feeling among an alarming number of men that women with any degree of perceived power, success, or influence do not deserve their positions in male-dominated fields, and that therefore they must be using manipulative or duplicitous means to gain and hold on to those positions. When women experience harassment and harm, we are blamed for the abuse we receive and regularly told that we were either asking for it or inventing it entirely. Again, what I've described to you today is not unique to me and my experience. Every day, many women voicing their opinions online deal with a similar flood of slander and defamation designed to undermine their careers, their credibility, their resolve, and their confidence. So I leave you with one simple thought. One of the most radical things you can do is to actually believe women when they tell you about their experiences. Thank you.
You're listening to Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.